Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. There hasn't been a better time to put down roots. Mortgage rates still hover below 4%, and the market is flooded with homes, if you can afford one. Lenders have tightened up after the bubble burst, and people just don't have as much money, but it may still be cheaper to call yourself a homeowner. A recent report from real estate website Trulia found it's considerably more affordable in several U.S. cities to buy a home instead of renting one. Joining me now from San Francisco is Trulia's chief economist and head of analytics, Jed Kolko. Welcome to the show, Jed.
Thanks very much, Ann.
So it's hard to believe, you know, just 4 years ago, we were in this, you know, death spiral, you know, in the whole economy being led by the housing troubles. It's a much different market than it was, though. What's changed that made homeownership so much more affordable?
That's right. When we think back to about 4 years ago, the economy was in recession, but a lot of the pain in the housing market had already started even a couple years before that. Starting in about 2006, home prices started to fall, and a lot of those overbuilt areas where developers had built so many new housing units, were starting to just be vacant. As a result, prices have really plummeted by some indexes by more than a third nationally, and in some parts of the country by more than half. And as prices have fallen so much, lots of people lost their homes, ended up becoming renters, and lots of first people who would otherwise have been first-time home buyers also chose to rent instead. So we saw prices fall hugely. And at the same time, we've seen rents rise in most parts of the country as homeownership has fallen and people are renting instead of owning. So higher rents plus much, much lower prices has made homeownership more affordable than it's been in many years.
I don't know about San Francisco, but out here, they're building apartments and rentals like gangbusters again.
That's right. So in the Columbus area, rents are up considerably in the past year or so, and we've seen, starting about a year ago, a big increase in apartment construction. That's been true nationally and in a lot of areas around the country. That hasn't brought much relief to renters yet, because a typical big rental building takes a year or more to be completed, but we should start seeing some of those new rental units come onto the market soon, and that should slow down the rent increases at least somewhat for renters.
Just joining us, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Jed Kolko. He's calling us from San Francisco, where he's the chief economist and head of analytics at Trulia.com. We'll have that website link for you at our website at WOSU.org/allsides. You mentioned the housing developments that where there so many people went into foreclosure. And I just know that for a lot of reasons, if there's one place I wouldn't want to move, it'd be one of those developments where every other house is the grass is overgrown and it's just a mess. What's happening to those places now?
We are starting to see the vacancy rate fall. And in some places, we've seen the vacancy rate fall a lot. We've had so many years now after the bubble burst, a very low construction, very little construction. 2009, 10, and 11, construction was, you know, a slight shadow of its former self. That's meant that as the populations continue to grow, people have bought up or rented some of those new homes. That means there's a lot less vacancy than there was at the worst point during the housing crisis, and a lot less inventory. And especially for sellers and for homeowners looking at their home values, that's good news. It does make it harder for buyers and renters who are looking for a place, because fewer units on the market means there's less for them to choose from. But it is good news for sellers and for homeowners.
For a while, getting a loan to buy a house was a big problem, even though the interest rates were at below 4%, which is incredible. If you didn't have a pristine credit record, or if there was some other check against you, the banks just didn't go for you.
That's still a problem. The lending standards today are still very tight. One needs a very high credit score, even to qualify for a mortgage in the first place, even more so if you want to get one of the best loans today of about 3.5%. So tight lending standards are still a big barrier that's preventing people from taking advantage of what are very low home prices relative to the past. The other is saving enough for a down payment. Mm-hmm. You know, it takes years to save enough for a down payment. And after this recession, when lots of people lost their jobs or had to work part-time, people are a lot farther from having enough for a down payment than they had been. So those are the two big obstacles to taking advantage of the fact that it is much cheaper to buy than to rent in the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, back 20-odd years ago when I bought my first house, they recommended something like 20% down was the recommendation, and that's what you were shooting for. Of course, houses were cheaper as well. But when we went through this big the bubble and people were getting home loans without anything down, that's all changed.
Right now, the typical new purchaser is putting about 12% down.
Okay.
Now, that combines, you know, a lot of loans that are the traditional 20% down, but a lot of loans are through the FHA, where it's possible to put 3.5% down so long as you're also paying mortgage insurance on top of that. It really goes to how much you can pay up front versus whether you want to add fees in an ongoing way.
This is a little bit off topic, but maybe you can respond to it. Have banks gotten any better at handling this surplus of assets that nobody wanted for so long? All those vacant houses that they had foreclosed on.
Now that prices are rising, it's a better deal for banks to start selling some of the homes that they've been holding on to.
Okay.
As prices continue to rise, and prices have been rising for most of the year in most of the country, we will start to see sellers, whether they're individual homeowners or banks, put more of the homes that they're holding on to on the market. But banks do still have a lot of that inventory of unsold homes. They're also backed up in terms of mortgages. Because rates are so low and so many people are refinancing, it's taking longer for that process to go through at the front end. And so, yes, banks are backed up.
Yeah, as far as doing the mortgages, it's just kind of like the old days again. They're checking your records, and they're checking them twice and three times.
If you want to get a mortgage today, you really do need to have all that paperwork in place. Your credit history's got to be in good shape. You've got to be able to prove that you've got a steady stream of income. That's harder for people who are self-employed or have non-traditional sources of income. And so, you know, for a lot of people, it is hard to get that mortgage. Again, if you can, it's a great time, but lots of people aren't even in the game to ask the question whether it makes more sense to rent or buy.
Are tax deductions a big part of the draw to buy? And what do you think would happen to the market if the deduction was taken away, which is what is being suggested at the federal level?
The tax deduction does play a big part in the decision to rent or to buy. Right now, prices are so low relative to rent and mortgage rates are so low that even without the deduction, it would still make more sense if you could afford the down payment and qualify for a mortgage to buy than to rent. But it makes a big difference for a couple of reasons. First of all, people are able to deduct their mortgage interest, but they're also able to deduct their property taxes, both of which are important costs of home ownership.
So if they went away, how much of an impact would that have? To what degree is it important?
It would have the biggest impact, first of all, for higher-income taxpayers who are in a higher income tax bracket. Because it's a deduction, the way it works is you benefit more the higher the tax bracket you're in. It also would matter more in places where homes are more expensive. So the geographic impact would really be focused on some of the more expensive parts of the country. In those areas, we would likely see a modest decrease in home ownership. Again, the main barrier is saving for that down payment. We'd also see people buying less home than they would otherwise. So it's not just a question of buying a home or not buying a home. It's also how much house you end up buying.
Well, that's interesting because are people being more conservative about what they buy now anyway?
During the recession, people reported that they were interested in smaller homes. So people's aspirations pulled back during the recession. But, you know, now, just as we're coming out of that recession and are in the recovery, people are already once again saying that their ideal home size is, you know, back up to where it was a few years earlier. And we're seeing new home builders putting larger homes on the market than they have been. So even the home builders have stepped a bit away from the smaller homes that they were building during the recession.
Trulia has a list of the most affordable cities for home ownership, and Toledo is one of them. And Toledo's suffered a great deal from the recession, much more than, say, the Central Ohio and Columbus area has. So, yeah, I get it, it's more affordable, but there are fewer jobs there, too. I mean, what went into the list?
When we compared the cost of renting versus buying, we looked at what the same type of home, the same property, would sell for versus rent for in each of the 100 largest metros in the U.S. Then we took into account all of the other costs, both of owning and renting. So not just on the ownership side, monthly mortgage payment, but also the closing costs when you buy, the closing costs when you sell, insurance, renovations, maintenance, property taxes, and so on. We assumed people would stay put 7 years, which is the average that Americans have traditionally tended to stay put between moves. Based on that, figured out over a seven-year period whether it made more sense to rent versus buy. Now, the cheapest places to buy versus rent are places in the U.S. That have not seen a lot of home appreciation over the past many years. And those include many places in the Midwest, not Columbus, but other metros in Ohio, like Dayton, Toledo, and Cleveland, as well as Detroit and its suburbs. Some other places where it's cheapest to buy relative to renting are in the South and Southwest area, so Memphis, Oklahoma City, parts of Florida. At the other extreme, the places where buying is least affordable relative to renting. It's still cheaper than renting because rates are so low, but the gap is not as big where I am, here in San Francisco, in New York, other parts of California, Hawaii, places where homeownership has traditionally been so expensive, and therefore the gap between buying and renting is smaller.
Well, Jed, I want to say thanks to you for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Ann. I appreciate it. Thanks.
Jed Kolko, he is Trulia's chief economist and head of analytics, and at Trulia.com. If you want to check out that website, we'll have a link for you on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Coming up, we're going to hear from a local real estate agent. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm General Manager Tom Ryland, congratulating the WOSU News Team for being named the best radio news operation in Ohio and for winning Best Radio News Website. Hear more from our news team on 89.7 NPR News and online anytime at WOSU.org.
And if you support 89.7 NPR News right now, you'll be automatically entered to win an iPad. No pledge is necessary, but entries are only accepted at WOSU.org. The deadline is October 11th. Visit WOSU.org right now. 49 degrees with some sunshine, warming up to 67 today. Clear skies tonight, a low of 46. Support for 89.7 comes from Be-Dry Waterproofing. With a patented system that stops groundwater from entering a home's foundation, protecting more than 250,000 homeowners since 1958. More information at 1-800-563-BE-DRY or BeDry.com. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Home ownership is the American dream. We've been talking about affordability in our last segment. Now we're turning to the business of buying and selling here in Central Ohio. Real estate agents see both buyers and sellers and their wants and needs and try to meet somewhere in the middle. Joining me now is Carolyn Gifford. She's a licensed realtor with Real Living HER for the past 19 years. Welcome to the show, Carolyn.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
I never knew. Is it HER or HER?
It's H-E-R.
Okay,
it's
good.
The initials of the original owner.
Okay. It stalled me there for a second. So anyways, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Some sellers have had their homes on the market for months, even years now. And we have one in our neighborhood. Luckily, not only one that I know of. Are they doing something wrong, or is it just the market? What gives?
Well, oftentimes sellers make the mistake of listing a home too high, and they go into it with the attitude as, well, we'll try at this price, and if it doesn't sell, we'll come down. And what happens oftentimes is after 60 days or so on the market, a home just gets stale. And no matter what the price is, people lose interest. They think something's wrong with it. It just becomes, you know, almost stigmatized in people's minds. So it's just so critical that people price a house correctly up front. Now, some of the houses that have been sitting for a substantial amount of time, clearly they're just overpriced. I mean, there could be other issues, but, you know, it all boils down to price. I mean, everything will sell at the right price.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Carolyn Gifford, real estate agent for 19 years in the Central Ohio area. If you have a question or comment, have you had a recent experience trying to sell your home? We want to hear about it. Did it take a while, or did you have to sell at a loss, or did it just fly off the market? 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Some neighborhoods sell better than others. And it's not necessarily the newer neighborhoods that are selling better than others. Why is that?
Well, it seems in some of the newer areas, you're competing with new builds, and a buyer's mentality is, well, why would I buy this house that's 4 years old when I can still go build a new house for about the same price and get exactly what I want, you know, exactly the right paint colors, exactly the right flooring. So that's why some of the newer homes within the past 10 years really have struggled, because again, they're competing with the new builds. The areas that seem to have done the best would be in Arlington or a Bexley, where they're landlocked, there's only so much real estate available. There's no new builds there to compete with, and if somebody wants to live there, they're going to have to buy from existing inventory.
The biggest mistake that sellers make, you said, is the pricing. It all comes down to the pricing and pricing it right. Beyond that, beyond the price, after that, what do they need to do in this market?
Well, staging has become more and more popular, and it really does work in many homes.
Describe what that is.
You can hire a staging professional that will come in and bring furnishings that may be appealing to people. We always get asked the question as well, is it better to list my home with my furniture in it or vacant? And, you know, it boils down to, well, it kind of depends what your furniture looks like. Buyers have a hard time walking into a vacant house and seeing how they're going to live there. So if you can get it staged, you get a staging professional to come in, and you rent furniture from them. It's a fairly reasonable cost, and they help put some ideas in the buyer's mind of, oh, okay, this is what my house would look like when I move in.
They also talk about painting and sometimes get you to paint your house or what?
Yeah, definitely. Neutral colors are good. Sometimes you're battling with buyers that maybe have an unrealistic number in their mind that, you know, they might go into a house with some wallpaper and they think, oh my gosh, it's going to cost me $10,000 to take this wallpaper down, which it's not in reality. So the seller would be much better off in the long run if they just went ahead and neutralized the house themselves. And again, that goes down to pricing, or they're going to have to sell at a substantially reduced price if someone's going to tackle that themselves.
We were just talking about the market and how it is getting better for buyers, but are buyers kind of spoiled by this market too, that they're kind of asking for, you know, the world and expecting a lot more for their money than maybe they could have gotten, 10 years, but a lot less than what they could have gotten 3 or 4 years ago?
Definitely. We're seeing a lot of lower offers now. And, you know, the issue is the buyers will go in and they'll say, well, you know, it's a buyer's market. We should be able to offer these low prices. And then the sellers think, you know, they always try to go for a percent of list price. And I always try to explain to them, well, it kind of depends what your list price is. If it's a reasonable price, then you're going to get close to list. But if it's, you know, if you jack the price up, then you're not going to come near that.
I live in Worthington where it's landlocked, like you were describing earlier, and there have been bidding wars over houses that were built in 1967.
Right. Right.
Crazy.
Yeah. And that seems to be the type market that is doing really well right now, the mature, established neighborhoods. Because I think the neighborhoods that have really gotten hurt are the newer, the new builds that just don't have that history. And buyers are more comfortable now with the, you know, neighborhoods that have the mature trees, they have the community associations and all their traditions. And I think buyers just feel more comfortable because that's where the sales prices have, they've been hit, but not hit nearly as hard as some of the other areas.
I also mentioned earlier just going into some of those neighborhoods, the new builds that never were lived in, house after house. And then there's the vacant. They're kind of gap-toothed. Some of them didn't even have houses go up next door to them. It looks so depressing. Even if they're brand new houses and have never been lived in, how are those going?
They're not selling well at all. You see a lot of foreclosures and short sales in those newer neighborhoods because the prices have really dropped in those areas.
And they can't sell their house, and if they have to get out, that's where the foreclosures and the problems continue?
Correct. Yeah, a lot of that in the newer builds.
When, as a real estate agent, and you try to help people find a place to live, do you find yourself trying to, I don't know, I don't like to use the word talk somebody into, but how do you sell a neighborhood like that?
Like a newer build?
Like the new builds that were hit hard by the recession and the foreclosure crisis. How do you sell them now? How do you make them appealing?
Well, I always, when I'm working with a buyer, always want to make sure, even if they say, oh, this is going to be a house I'm going to be in for an extended period of time, I always think it's important to look at, you know, if something happens and you need to sell in 5 to 10 years, are you going to be able to do that? And that's where, you know, that's when you really got to look at pricing. And again, if you're going to buy in a new build area, you're always going to be competing with a newer house or someone that could be building their own house. Mm-hmm. And that's, again, why you've got to be priced pretty aggressively.
614-292-8513. If you want to speak with my guest, Carolyn Gifford, a real estate agent in the Central Ohio area for 19 years, we're talking about what it takes to sell your house and what you should be looking for in buying a new house or a new old house. 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can go to our Facebook page. Margaret in Cincinnati, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Margaret.
Yes. The realtor that is selling my house, she wouldn't let me counter offer back. When the buyer gave me an offer, the realtor wouldn't let me counter offer back.
Carolyn Gifford, what about that? Is there negotiations are pretty typical?
Oh, yeah. I always encourage people to negotiate just as hard and as long as they possibly can. You know, sometimes if a seller receives an offer and they think it's too low, oftentimes the seller's first reaction will be, I'm not even going to deal with it. I don't even want to talk to these people. And I always encourage them, definitely, you know, counter back, because a lot of buyers are offering low and they're willing to come up. They just want to, you know, play the game a little bit and see if they can get it for a steal, and you can't blame them because some houses you can get for a really good price. So I always try to tell the sellers to not get too emotional about it. Just look at it as a business transaction and keep the negotiations going. Now, in that situation, I don't know why an agent would ever tell someone not to counteroffer back. Mm-hmm. Unless there must be some other issue involved there that I'm not aware of, but I cannot think of a situation where I would ever tell someone not to counter back if they're willing to do so.
Okay, Margaret, thanks for that call. Jean in Columbus, you're on the air with Carolyn Gifford.
We want to move a little bit further away from the city, but the suburban property taxes seem just so high.
Do property taxes, can they be that much of a turnoff, Carolyn?
They can be. They can be. It's definitely, you know, it's a substantial portion of your monthly payment, so it's definitely something you've got to consider. And it depends what you're looking for. You know, if you're looking for a certain school district, then you know you're going to have to pay with taxes that go along with that.
Really not. Really just looking for a safe place, but they all seem to be. All the nicest places seem to be, for example, a two-bedroom ranch with $9,000 a year property taxes just floored us.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that does sound like a lot.
Okay, thank you.
I want to check out a reappraisal on that.
Yeah, $9,000 property taxes, that seems like a lot.
Yeah. Jean, thank you. What about communities that are more diverse? And I'm not talking about racially or ethnically or anything like that. I'm talking about in terms of the housing stock, where there's the fancy houses, there's the not so fancy houses, there's the established neighborhoods, there's apartments, there's condos, there's places for older people to live. Because I know that Dublin was having a problem with that. They were just too kind of monolithically suburbia with mm-hmm. cul-de-sacs, and they needed more.
Right, and I think Dublin also is an area that's been growing, mm-hmm. and there's just a lot of inventory there. So if someone wants to move into Dublin, they have a plethora of options, and so I think that's holding their values a little lower than they'd like to see there, where, again, in some of the other areas, like, you know, you brought up Worthington, more landlocked, Arlington, Bexley, some of the downtown communities, if people want to be in those areas, they have to buy from existing inventory, and it's helping the prices stabilizer. They are starting to go up a little bit, which is certainly nice to see.
Chuck in Buckeye Lake, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Chuck.
Yeah, I have one of the most beautiful homes out here at Buckeye Lake, right on the lake, and I put it for sale by owner, and I get some of the most ridiculous calls from people, you know, and they know it's a very nice home, and people say, well, I'll give you $200,000, $300,000. I've had about 8 calls, and some of the people just can't get the financing. And I don't know what I'm doing wrong.
You need to list it with me. I'll give you my information.
Well, you're trying to sell it yourself.
I couldn't walk away from that one.
You're trying to sell it yourself, right, Chuck?
Yes. Okay. I had it with a realtor at one time, and he wasn't doing a good job. And I have more people. They want to put it on the house of tours every year. But I don't want 600 or 700 people going through the house. I mean, it was built by an executive from Dow Chemical, and he got transferred. I've been here 18 years. I want to move to Columbus. That's where my businesses are. But everybody stops once you come in. Realtors want to have open house. I don't want to do that. And I just don't know what to do. And I want to sell before winter. It's really a fantastic home.
Well, without pitching yourself too much, Carolyn. what do you recommend for? I know that, you know, any realtor is going to say to somebody like Chuck, well, you need a real estate agent, but without one, what do you recommend?
Well, you said people have come with different prices. Do you have the house priced at a certain point, or are you just kind of letting people make offers?
Well, about 2.5 years ago, it was appraised at $1.3 million. I'm trying to sell it now for $775,000. I have to have enough money for a down payment on the home that I want to buy in Columbus. And people want me to give it to them, you know, and I just can't afford to do that.
Right, right. And as we touched on a little bit earlier, buyers are making low offers right now because there are some people that will snatch those up just to make a move. So I think it's just something you have to stick to your guns and accept. If someone's going to offer you, you know, something like $200,000, obviously that's not something you're willing to take. But this goes back to the negotiation point. Keep the conversation going, you know, tell them it was appraised at this and you know, see if you can work with them and keep the conversation going and try to get them up higher.
What about, Chuck mentioned that he didn't want to have open houses. And I know there's a difference between open houses and having somebody make an appointment and see it. But how successful or do open houses matter that much anymore?
Not as much as people would think. A lot of times agents will hold open houses, honestly, trying to pick up unattached buyers that come through the house.
Mm-hmm.
Every once in a while you get lucky and a house will sell to someone who comes through the open house. It's not real common. And I would think a house like you're describing, you're probably going to get a lot of people that just want to come and see the home. So I probably not a good house for an open house.
Good luck, Chuck.
Yes.
Take care.
Thank you, Ann. Yep. Wonderful show.
Oh, thank you, Chuck. Thanks for listening. From a listener on Facebook, you may or may not be able to respond to this, Carolyn, but let's give it a swat. The listener says, I have about $5,000 left on my student loans. My wife tells me we are on track to have it paid off by June 2013. How does paying it off first look to the banks when trying to get a home loan? Could still having an open student loan help when trying to get approved because it is viewed as good debt? Is that true? If so, why? Because that makes no sense to me. So I know you're not a banker, but in general, when you have that kind of debt,
well, people, my understanding, the mortgage industry changes so quickly, but they will look at what your monthly obligations are. So they, it sounds like they may be trying to pay it off quicker, which is certainly a great thing. But when the bank looks at them and their ability to obtain a mortgage, they're going to look at just what their required monthly payment is. So that just kind of goes into their, you know, their debt load of what they can afford monthly.
And also, it's a choice you're making between paying off the loan and maybe socking the money away for a down payment.
Exactly. Right. Right. It's just a choice.
We still have a few minutes left with Carolyn Gifford. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Amy in Cleveland Heights, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Amy.
Hi. Thank you. Basically, I want to know, when is enough enough? We bought an old house that needed a lot of work, including the sales price. We've already put in about $250,000 worth of renovations of kitchens, baths, electrical, plumbing, and things keep going wrong every time we turn around. We just had a ceiling collapse in our guest bedroom the other day, as a matter of fact.
That happened to me once.
So, you know, all the houses around us are going for about $250,000, and they're big, you know, houses. We saw a couple of spikes of, you know, maybe over $300,000 sales in the past couple years. But we're just wondering, you know, when do we cut our losses? Or, I don't know, we're kind of in over our heads. And do you have any advice for people like us?
Now, Cleveland Heights is a lovely neighborhood, though.
It is. For sure.
Yeah, there's some very large, we talked about established neighborhoods earlier, and that's certainly a very nice, large homes, established neighborhoods. But sometimes that happens with larger homes. There's, you know, more things to go wrong, more areas that need renovated and things like that. Boy, it's tough because when you start on one room, it just makes the other rooms look like they need work, and it's tough to figure out where you draw the line. You know,
right.
The main things are that if you're trying to get your house towards the point of putting on the market, you know, the big things, if you had a ceiling collapse, that would make me think maybe there's a roof issue. Obviously, the roof, you know, the big things, the roof, the windows, the kitchens, those are the big ticket items that you're really going to want to make sure are solid and in good condition. You know, mm-hmm. People can sometimes look past some of the other things and think, well, I can do down the road, but and another thing is sometimes you might get a house in contract, but then those things will come up on the home inspection. And so sellers can get hit twice because they feel like, well, we negotiated on the house because of the current condition. So we agreed to a lower sales price, and then they have a home inspection, and a buyer may go through and say, okay, now that I've done my home inspection, I think the house needs all new windows. So we're going to take another, you know, $7,000-$10,000 off. And so sellers end up feeling like they're getting hit twice.
So maybe we should focus less on a lot of the cosmetic details of making sure that all the rooms are, you know, really neutrally painted and, you know, pretty for people to walk into, and much more on like the structural, you know, okay, maybe replace the roof and we'll get a better kind of return on our investment than we would if you know,
if it
we
looks
spend.
Pretty. Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Good luck, Amy. Carolyn Gifford, thanks for joining us.
Sure. Thanks for having me, Ann.
Carolyn Gifford's a real estate agent at HER Real Living. Coming up, we're going to talk to a couple of home builders, one who does the big fancy customs and the other that does the more middle of the road. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Look at a congressional map of Texas, and you'll see some funny shapes, like the 27th District in South Texas.
It's shaped like a Glock pistol.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist Robert Draper tells us about redrawing congressional boundaries and how Republicans made the most of their gains in the 2010 elections. Draper writes about it in The Atlantic magazine. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in just about 20 minutes, starting at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Some of the most amazing, creative, and innovative structures on Earth are not man-made or urban. They are the residences built by animals in the natural world. Guided by instinct, animal architects build a remarkable variety of elaborate dwellings with their simple supplies. Watch Nature, the Animal House, Wednesday night at 8 on WOSU-TV. And it's just about 50 degrees, sunshine, a high of 67 today. Clear skies for tonight, a low of 46. Support for 89.7 comes from Home Care Assistance, in-home care for older adults with a philosophy of promoting health, well-being, and quality of life for all clients, no matter their limitations. Information on Home Care Assistance is at 481-8888. That's 481-8888. And support for 89.7 comes from Home Instead Senior Care, offering online educational programs for the community. Information about Alzheimer's and assistance managing loved ones' difficult behaviors can be found at helpforalzheimersfamilies.com or by calling 486-6643. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
While home building has slowed, it hasn't stopped. There's still a demand for new. No one knows that better than our guest now, Mark Bronsdorf of Compass Homes. It's a custom home builder in the Columbus area. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Thank you.
And also with us, Brian Pohl. He's marketing manager for Rockford Homes, which is considered in the industry a production builder. Welcome to the show, Brian. Hello, Brian.
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, good. Great.
Thank you for having me.
I hung up on you once today.
No problem.
For our listeners, custom builders usually build on your lot and offer more client-specific floor plans. Production builders usually build on land they own and are large volume builders. What's your preference? What are you looking at? 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, Mark, I've got a huge list. Mark and Brian, I've got a huge list of trends. And I imagine that they're different for the production builders than they are for the custom homes. I thought we could start with Brian and tell us, from the production point of view, what's changed, what's new?
Well, and, you know, one of the things we've noticed in our production side of the business is we've had to become more flexible. You know, one of the things we've been seeing from some of our competitors is that, yeah, new is very desirable, like you said, when we opened up the segment, but we've had to learn how to become more flexible as a production builder. You know, if people want what they want, they like new, but along with that, they may want a certain extension or a larger bathroom or different things that they're looking to do. And as a production builder, we've had to retool our business model a little bit to adjust for those kinds of demands. People do want what they want, and we've had to shift a little bit to accommodate some of those things. Where a production builder can do some amazing things, we can do some things that fit the bill just well, too.
Now, for 35 years, the American home grew larger and larger and larger, and now it's up to an average about 2,100, a little more than 2,100 square feet. Is that about what you're looking at now?
Yeah, we're seeing, you know, a broader range of questions and demands out there, but that's a pretty strong average, although I think people are looking for more value, and typically more value equates to a little bit larger square footage in their home. Even one-story or ranch plans, you know, probably, you know, get to that range of square footage, but two-story range is probably 2,500 to 2,600 square foot here in Columbus.
And Mark Bronsdorf, we think of the custom homes, they're fancier, they're, you know, if you have a little bit more money, you can afford a custom home, you have some nice property out somewhere. But sometimes they seem so luxurious to some people. Are even custom home builders getting a little bit more practical?
They are, in particular, just as Brian had said, there's some changes
gotten tighter, there's less lots out there for just the individual consumer to buy. So even as a custom builder, myself and then competitors are buying some lots as well as building on land the homeowners provide. And I also, I would agree with what Brian's saying about square footage is people are looking for value, and it is much easier to add value to a house with square footage than it is with features. So we're seeing fairly large homes being built just because they're trying to drive that value in, and that's driven somewhat by the appraisal market.
Is the square footage up going up? I mean, those big, huge cathedral ceilings, is that part of the value still? When it comes to practicality, it's not very practical.
We've actually seen a dramatic shift away from that. That actually never counted as square footage. That was
right.
Two-story space.
So it just felt bigger to a lot of people.
It felt bigger. We've seen a change. In fact, our company builds very few two-story great rooms. We do it, but if a client wants it, but what we found is at our price point, which is generally, we call it a second or third time move up, and we certainly have first time move ups or even first time buyers. I've sold houses for $750,000 to first time buyers before, but what's happened is once they've bought their, we typically say they buy their first house, they buy what they can afford, their second house, they buy all the things they think they need, the two-story great room and what have you, and they get to their second time move up or third time move up, and they say, I don't need that anymore. We're seeing a lot more 10-foot ceilings, a lot more ceiling treatments such as coffered ceilings, but that closing of the great room is an interesting thing because there's still a lot of plans that were good where they're closing that great room and adding maybe an additional bedroom or making the bedrooms larger or the closets larger or adding a bonus room above, and they're really gaining, in many cases, as much as 400 to 500 square feet by closing the foyer and the great room, that the same house built 6 years ago would have been 600 square feet less, but almost no difference in cost. So they're actually, the square footage is going up and they're driving value. And I would imagine that, quite frankly, a company like Rockford, where Brian is, sees more two-story great rooms than we do just because people move through that trend. They like it. And then once they've lived it, a lot of them, as they move up beyond that, say, don't really need it. Mm-hmm. So,
is that the case, Brian?
Yeah, very much so. I want to, echo on Mark's, comments. So that's so true. We find that, people do come in and say, well, that's what we want. Wow, that's the wow room.
Mm-hmm.
They do find that they, on their third try, they go back and do some retooling. And I think it's a natural progression that probably someone who buys a Rockford home may come back and buy with us, but they may find a company like Mark's and really build some exact things that they want, and that's exactly what Nikki described. They're going to put that, extra bedroom or that extra suite above where that two-story space was and really benefit and get the value out of that space and make it work for them. 10-foot ceilings, a big trend that Mark said is very, very, very popular and very, what people want right now because they want to make sure their house is what they want. So it's very true.
To what extent is environmental concerns coming into play? And I guess another way to put it is utilities. I mean, looking forward 20 or 30 years, utilities are going to become more and more an expense. And I'm thinking in terms of the long-term value of the home in that way, too. Is that an issue, Brian?
Well, yeah, definitely. And that's probably one of the bigger advantages of buying new right now. If you bought a house that's 20 years old, versus a house that's brand new today. There's so much technology that's changed in 20 years, even 10 years for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
The way we insulate homes, the way that the furnaces and the hot water tanks and different appliances even that you purchase for your new home, so much has come such a long, long way in efficiency and the way it works and operates to save you money. Windows and insulation and just so many variables I can talk on a big scale right now
mm-hmm.
that really affect that utility bill or what you're paying to live there. People are looking for that value too that comes inherently with a new home. And it's a big, big, big trend right now.
And Mark Bronsdorf, even though your price point doesn't necessarily have to worry about the cost of utilities, is there some kind of conscientiousness in play these days with the big houses?
Definitely. Absolutely. In fact, we are an Energy Star builder, and the Energy Star program has gotten dramatically more difficult to accomplish in the last few years. And it was a little bit whitewashed. Almost everybody in the market was Energy Star, and now it's going to be, you're going to see those builders that are truly Energy Star truly do have an understanding of how to make the house more efficient. We see a lot of things, and the closing of the great room, that was a very big heat drain.
Mm-hmm.
There's a number of things we do that environmentally really drive down the cost of utilities. The efficiency of the shape of the house, for mm-hmm. instance, will have a big impact. And people that are, what's interesting is people in our price point, and we're certainly in, you know, we start in the mid 300s, but our average is probably more around 500. People in our price point are very often can do, we'll sit there and do the analysis and say, hey, if I can save $100 a month in my utilities, and it cost me $50 a month to pay for the upgrades in my mortgage, it's worth it. Even though they may not get paid back for a while, from a cash-to-cash perspective, it makes sense. So it's not just let me get the lowest price, it's let me get the lowest total operating cost. Much more the way people buy a car. People buy a car and they look at what's it going to cost me to buy it, what's it going to cost me to insure it and right. put gas in it. They're sort of, we're seeing when they're a little more sophisticated buying a house, and that's just a function of having owned a house and paid the utilities, and owned, you know, usually our buyers have owned one or two houses, and they may have owned an old house and then a newer house that might have even been built 10 years ago. And Brian's right, the changes in the last 10 years and really the last 5 years have been dramatic in that area of exactly the building science that's gone into it. And there are things that 10 or 15 years ago you rarely saw that maybe 6 or 7 years ago you started to see all the custom builders do that now all builders do.
Mm-hmm.
And so it actually comes a little bit downhill. The energy efficiency tends to be built at the higher end first, just because people can afford to put it in, and then, you know, it sort of works down from the top.
Brian, you mentioned that there's more flexibility in your building plans now to attract the market that you need to. To what extent do you advise people on what kind of home they build in terms of resale and how valuable it would be? I asked that particularly. I knew somebody who, they didn't want a bathtub. They never wanted a bathtub again. They didn't put a bathtub in their house, no matter how much people told them, you're an idiot. And they had a very hard time selling that house because it didn't have a darn bathtub in it.
You know, that's such a good point to bring up. You know, we try to train our sales force to have a little bit of vision for what's down the road. You know, most people think, well, gosh, this is the home I'm going to build. I'm going to live here for 20 years. You know, the research and the statistics show us that, you know, most people stay in their home from about 7 years on average
mm-hmm.
Before they move to their next home. So we try to give them some advice. You know, you might want to consider this or you might want to consider that. We want to find out what their need is, you know, and what their want is. But then again, try to give some counsel where we think it's, you know, relevant and important, because, you know, having that bathtub, like you said, can really make a difference when they go to resale. You don't want to focus your entire investment on what it's going to be when you resale it, but you want to make sure you give, you know, some good advice for what they want right now, here and today, you know, and then tomorrow and down the road, what happens then if they do consider, you know, selling. Or, you know, a lot of people are transient. They relocate and they go to other positions and other jobs, and sometimes those jobs are in other marketplaces. So, you know, ultimately they may have to sell their home someday, and they want to make sure you've given some good advice on what that entails.
Yeah, to what extent does that go into your relationship with your clients, Mark Bronsdorf? You know, I know people who decided they weren't going to get the granite countertop. They didn't care about having a granite countertop. They got just a regular old countertop, and it made a difference in selling their house and their higher price point.
I have not yet met that person that didn't want the granite countertop yet.
I know, and I actually have.
Me neither, Mark.
Well, now, but this was 15 years ago when, you know, in that large...
Well,
this was
much more of a luxury item.
And it was a luxury house, though, that they didn't want to put that luxury item into.
And some of those things, and we certainly have the same conversations that Brian does, or that their salespeople at Rockford do. At Compass, we sit down with people and we do talk, and we have people that come in and say, this is what I want. And we say, we really recommend, you know, build what you're looking for yourself, but be aware you are going to eventually have to sell this house at some point. Now, there are some items what we look at and say, like we put hardwood floors in standard in our houses, mm-hmm. but not everywhere. And if somebody came in and said, I want tile or vinyl or whatever, and we said, well, from a resale perspective, that's not the end of the world to change. It, like granite countertops. You don't put granite countertops in. Somebody moves, buys the house and wants granite countertops. It's something somebody can certainly change, or they can change before they sell the house.
Mm-hmm.
But something like eliminating a bathtub. Now, interestingly, more than half the houses we sell don't have that large soaking tub in the master.
And I'm not talking, they said no bathtub.
No bathtub.
No place to wash the grandkids. Yeah.
That's exactly the conversation we've had. We've had people said, I want to change all the tubs to showers and no tub in the master. We said, don't do that.
Right.
Because when you resell it, you got to have at least a tub in the house. Because no matter what, if somebody has little kids or grandkids, they got to be able to give them a bath. And that's exactly, and we have that same conversation. And we would strongly recommend, and there are things where in certain neighborhoods, I'm sure Brian sees this too, there's certain neighborhoods where everybody's got a three-car garage or everybody's got a two-car garage.
Right.
And if somebody was going to build a one-car garage or a two-car, depending on the neighborhood, I'd look and say, this is really going to hurt you on resale, because when you go to resale, if 95% of the neighborhood's three-car garage, you're going to get ruled out over and over and over. But there are trends of things that are changing that, quite frankly, we've seen the dining room disappear from half the houses we built. However, mm-hmm. when it disappears, the breakfast area has become much larger and more of its own room. So instead of having a dinette or a breakfast room and a dining room, they've now got one dining room, but typically it's on the back of the house, much more connected to the great room in the kitchen. So it's gone down to one dining space. And if done right, we don't see that as an issue for resale just because of all the trends we're seeing.
And
I agree with you with the bathtub.
This is in a high price point, too. Brian Pohl, are you seeing that at Rockford as well, that flow through?
Absolutely. What Mark has talked about just now is so true in our business as well. We're finding that not only are people wanting to be more connected with their family, they want to be able to do it in a space that makes sense. That formal dining room is, depending on, again, the neighborhood and the culture and the buyer, we are seeing an extension in the back. People want bigger, dining areas off mm-hmm. their great room and kitchen and want to have one big flowing space. That's very, very true and very popular right now. People are trying to gear their house to the way they live, and most people live in the back of their house, not the front of their house. They're back by the great room, they're back by the kitchen, they're back by where all the activity is, where the game is, and what they're doing as a family. And as they have company and guests, and even sometimes extended families coming back home.
Right.
You've got mom coming back or dad coming back, even
or
a teenage kid or a graduate from college. Guess what, mom and dad, I need to move back home. that front of the room the front of the home is now maybe converted to a guest suite where you've got a guest bedroom and bathroom on the first floor. And now you're kicking things to the back of the home to live back there. So there's a lot of interesting changes happening with who's living in the home, not just what you have as a feature or benefit of the house.
Well, hopefully we can continue the conversation another time. Brian Pohl from Rockford Homes, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And Mark Bronsdorf, founder and president of Compass Homes. Mark, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks. It was a pleasure.
Thanks to everybody for listening. Be sure to like us on Facebook, follow the show on Twitter, and you can follow me on Twitter, too, at Ann Fisher, WOSU. Thanks for listening again. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.